They set up a little screen at the end of the truck and then came for us one at a time, unshackling us and leading us to the back of the truck. As close as I could work it, counting seconds off in my head, one hippopotami, two hippopotami, the interviews lasted about 7 minutes each. My head throbbed with dehydration and caffeine withdrawal. I was third, brought back by the woman with the severe haircut. Up close, she looked tired, with bags under her eyes and grim lines at the corners of her mouth. "Thanks," I said automatically, as she unlocked me with the remote and then dragged me to my feet. I hated myself for the automatic politeness, but it had been drilled into me. She didn't twitch a muscle. I went ahead of her to the back of the truck and behind the screen. There was a single folding chair, and I sat in it. Two of them, severe haircut lady and utility belt man, looked at me from their ergonomic super chairs. They had a little table between them with the contents of my wallet and backpack spread out on it. "Hello, Marcus," severe haircut lady said. "We have some questions for you." "Am I under arrest?" I asked. This wasn't an idle question. If you're not under arrest, there are limits on what the cops can and can't do to you. For starters, they can't hold you forever without arresting you, giving you a phone call, and letting you talk to a lawyer. And who, boy, was I ever going to talk to a lawyer? "What's this for?" she said, holding up my phone. The screen was showing the error message you got if you kept trying to get into its data without giving the right password. It was a bit of a rude message, an animated hand giving a certain universally recognized gesture, because I liked to customize my gear. "Am I under arrest?" I repeated. "They can't make you answer any questions if you're not under arrest, and when you ask if you're under arrest, they have to answer you. It's the rules." "You're being detained by the Department of Homeland Security," the woman snapped. "Am I under arrest?" "You're going to be more cooperative, Marcus, starting right now." She didn't say, "or else," but it was implied. "I would like to contact an attorney," I said. "I would like to know what I've been charged with. I would like to see some form of identification from both of you." The two agents exchanged looks. "I think you should really reconsider your approach to the situation," severe haircut lady said. "I think you should do that right now. We found a number of suspicious devices on your person. We found you and your confederates near the site of the worst terrorist attack this country has ever seen. Put those two facts together, and things don't look very good for you, Marcus. You can cooperate, or you can be very, very sorry. Now, what is this for? You think I'm a terrorist? I'm 17 years old! Just the right age. Al-Qaeda loves recruiting impressionable, idealistic kids. We Googled you, you know. You've posted a lot of very ugly stuff on the public internet." "I would like to speak to an attorney," I said. Severe haircut lady looked at me like I was a bug. "You're under the mistaken impression that you've been picked up by the police for a crime. You need to get past that. You are being detained as a potential enemy combatant by the government of the United States. If I were you, I'd be thinking very hard about how to convince us that you are not an enemy combatant. Very hard. Because there are dark holes that enemy combatants can disappear into. Very dark, deep holes. Holes where you can just vanish. Forever. Are you listening to me, young man? I want you to unlock this phone and then decrypt the files in its memory. I want you to account for yourself. Why were you out on the street? What do you know about the attack on this city?" "I'm not going to unlock my phone for you," I said, indignant. My phone's memory had all kinds of private stuff on it. Photos, emails, little hacks and mods I'd installed. That's private stuff.
"What have you got to hide?"
"I've got the right to my privacy," I said. "And I want to speak to an attorney."
"This is your last chance, kid. Honest people don't have anything to hide."
"I want to speak to an attorney." My parents would pay for it. All the FAQs on getting arrested were clear on this point. Just keep asking to see an attorney, no matter what they say or do. There's no good that comes of talking to the cops without your lawyer present. These two said they weren't cops, but if this wasn't an arrest, what was it? In hindsight, maybe I should have unlocked my phone for them. Chapter 4. They reshackled and rehooded me and left me there. A long time later, the truck started to move, rolling downhill, and then I was hauled back to my feet. I immediately fell over. My legs were so asleep they felt like blocks of ice, all except my knees, which were swollen and tender from all the hours of kneeling. Hands grabbed my shoulders and feet, and I was picked up like a sack of potatoes. There were indistinct voices around me, someone crying, someone cursing. I was carried a short distance, then set down and reshackled to another railing. My knees wouldn't support me anymore, and I pitched forward, ending up twisted on the ground like a pretzel, straining against the chains holding my wrists. Then we were moving again, and this time it wasn't like driving in a truck. The floor beneath me rocked gently and vibrated with heavy diesel engines, and I realized I was on a ship. My stomach turned to ice. I was being taken off America's shores to somewhere else, and who the hell knew where that was? I'd been scared before, but this thought terrified me, left me paralyzed and wordless with fear. I realized that I might never see my parents again, and I actually tasted a little vomit burn up my throat. The bag over my head closed in on me, and I could barely breathe, something that was compounded by the weird position I was twisted into. But, mercifully, we weren't on the water for very long. It felt like an hour, but I know now that it was a mere 15 minutes, and then I felt us docking, felt footsteps on the decking around me, and felt other prisoners being unshackled and carried or led away. When they came for me, I tried to stand again, but couldn't, and they carried me again, impersonally, roughly. When they took the hood off again, I was in a cell. The cell was old and crumbled and smelled of sea air. There was one window high up and rusted bars guarded it. It was still dark outside. There was a blanket on the floor and a little metal toilet without a seat set into the wall. The guard who took off my hood grinned at me and closed the solid steel door behind him. I gently massaged my legs, hissing as the blood came back into them and into my hands. Eventually I was able to stand, and then to pace. I heard other people talking, crying, shouting. I did some shouting too. Kolu! Daryl! Vanessa! Other voices on the cell block took up the cry, shouting out names too, shouting out obscenities. The nearest voices sounded like drunks losing their minds on a street corner. Maybe I sounded like that too. Guards shouted at us to be quiet, and that just made everyone yell louder. Eventually, we were all howling, screaming our heads off, screaming our throats raw. Why not? What did we have to lose? The next time they came to question me, I was filthy and tired, thirsty and hungry. Severe haircut lady was in the new questioning party, as were three big guys who moved me around like a cut of meat. One was black, the other two were white, though one might have been Hispanic. They all carried guns. It was like a Benetton's ad crossed with the game of Counter-Strike. They'd taken me from my cell and chained my wrists and ankles together. I paid attention to my surroundings as we went. I heard water outside and thought that maybe we were on Alcatraz. It was a prison, after all, even if it had been a tourist attraction for generations, the place where you went to see where Al Capone and his gangster contemporaries did their time. But I'd been to Alcatraz on a school trip. It was old and rusted, medieval. This place felt like it dated back to World War II. Not colonial times. There were barcodes, laser printed on stickers and placed on each of the cell doors, and numbers. But other than that, there was no way to tell who or what might be behind them. The interrogation room was modern, with fluorescent lights, ergonomic chairs, not for me, though. I got a folding plastic garden chair, and a big wooden boardroom table. A mirror lined one wall, just like in the cop shows, and I figured someone or other must be watching from behind it. Severe haircut lady and her friends helped themselves to coffee from an urn on a side table. I could have torn her throat out with my teeth and taken her coffee just then, and then set a styrofoam cup of water down next to me, without unlocking my wrists from behind my back, so I couldn't reach it. Hardy har har.
"Hello, Marcus," severe haircut lady said. "How's your tooth doing today?"
I didn't say anything.
"This isn't as bad as it gets, you know," she said. "This is as good as it gets from now on. Even once you tell us what we want to know, even if that convinces us that you were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, you're a marked man now. We'll be watching you everywhere you go and everything you do. You've acted like you've got something to hide, and we don't like that."
It's pathetic, but all my brain could think about was that phrase, "Convince us that you are in the wrong place at the wrong time." This was the worst thing that had ever happened to me. I had never, ever felt this bad or this scared before. Those words, "wrong place at the wrong time," those 6 words, they were like a lifeline dangling before me as I thrashed to stay on the surface.
"Hello, Marcus!"
She snapped her fingers in front of my face.
"Over here, Marcus!"
There was a little smile on her face, and I hated myself for letting her see my fear.
"Marcus, it can be a lot worse than this. This isn't the worst place we can put you, not by a damn sight."
She reached down below the table and came out with a briefcase, which she snapped open. From it, she withdrew my phone, my ARFID sniper cloner, my Wi-Finder, and my memory keys. She set them down on the table, one after the other.
"Here's what we want from you. You unlock the phone for us today. If you do that, you'll get outdoor and bathing privileges. You'll get a shower, and you'll be allowed to walk around in the exercise yard. Tomorrow we'll bring you back and ask you to decrypt the data on these memory sticks. Do that, and you'll get to eat in the mess hall. The day after, we're going to want your email passwords, and that will get you library privileges."
The word "no" was on my lips, like a burp trying to come up, but it wouldn't come. "Why?" is what came out instead.
"We want to be sure that you're what you seem to be. This is about your security, Marcus. Say you're innocent. You might be, though why an innocent man would act like he's got so much to hide is beyond me. But say you are. You could have been on that bridge when it blew. Your parents could have been. Your friends. Don't you want us to catch the people who attacked your home?"
It's funny, but when she was talking about my getting privileges, it scared me into submission. I felt like I'd done something to end up where I was, like maybe it was partially my fault, like I could do something to change it. But as soon as she switched to this BS about safety and security, my spine came back. "Lady," I said, "you're talking about attacking my home. But as far as I can tell, you're the only one who's attacked me lately. I thought I lived in a country with a constitution. I thought I lived in a country where I had rights. You're talking about defending my freedom by tearing up the Bill of Rights." A flicker of annoyance passed over her face, then went away.
"So melodramatic, Marcus. No one's attacked you. You've been detained by your country's government while we seek details on the worst terrorist attack ever perpetrated on our nation's soil. You have it within your power to help us fight this war on our nation's enemies. You want to preserve the Bill of Rights? Help us stop bad people from blowing up your city. Now, you have exactly 30 seconds to unlock that phone before I send you back to your cell. We have lots of other people to interview today."
She looked at her watch. I rattled my wrists, rattled the chains that kept me from reaching around and unlocking the phone. Yes, I was going to do it. She'd told me what my path was to freedom, to the world, to my parents. And that had given me hope. Now she'd threatened to send me away, to take me off that path. And my hope had crashed, and all I could think of was how to get back on it. So I rattled my wrists, wanting to get to my phone and unlock it for her, and she just looked at me coldly, checking her watch. "The password," I said, finally understanding what she wanted of me. She wanted me to say it out loud, here, where she could record it, where her pals could hear it. She didn't want me to just unlock the phone. She wanted me to submit to her, to put her in charge of me, to give up every secret, all my privacy. "The password," I said again, and then I told her the password. God help me, I submitted to her will. She smiled a little prim smile, which had to be her Ice Queen equivalent of a touchdown dance, and the guards led me away. As the door closed, I saw her bend down over the phone and key the password in. I wish I could say that I'd anticipated this possibility in advance and created a fake password that unlocked a completely innocuous partition on my phone, but I wasn't nearly that paranoid clever. You might be wondering at this point what dark secrets I had locked away on my phone and memory sticks and email. I'm just a kid, after all. The truth is, I had everything to hide, and nothing. Between my phone and my memory sticks, you could get a pretty good idea of who my friends were, what I thought of them, all the goofy things we'd done. You could read the transcripts of the electronic arguments we'd carried out and the electronic reconciliations we'd arrived at. You see, I don't delete stuff. Why would I? Storage is cheap, and you never know when you're going to want to go back to that stuff, especially the stupid stuff. You know that feeling you get sometimes where you're sitting on the subway and there's no one to talk to and you suddenly remember some bitter fight you had, some terrible thing you said? Well, it's usually never as bad as you remember. Being able to go back and see it again is a great way to remind yourself that you're not as horrible a person as you think you are. Daryl and I have gotten over more fights that way than I can count. And even that's not it. I know my phone is private. I know my memory sticks are private. That's because of cryptography, message scrambling. The math behind crypto is good and solid, and you and me get access to the same crypto that banks and the National Security Agency use. There's only one kind of crypto that anyone uses, crypto that's public, open, and can be deployed by anyone. That's how you know it works. There's something really liberating about having some corner of your life that's yours, that no one gets to see except you. It's a little like nudity or taking a dump. Everyone gets naked every once in a while. Everyone has to squat on the toilet. There's nothing shameful, deviant, or weird about either of them. But what if I decreed that from now on, every time you went to evacuate some solid waste, you'd have to do it in a glass room perched in the middle of Times Square, and you'd be buck naked. Even if you've got nothing wrong or weird with your body, and how many of us can say that, you'd have to be pretty strange to like that idea. Most of us would run screaming. Most of us would hold it in until we exploded. It's not about doing something shameful. It's about doing something private. It's about your life, belonging to you. They were taking that from me, piece by piece. As I walked back to my cell, that feeling of deserving it came back to me. I'd broken a lot of rules all my life, and I'd gotten away with it, by and large. Maybe this was justice. Maybe this was my past coming back to me. After all, I had been where I was because I'd snuck out of school. I got my shower. I got to walk around the yard. There was a patch of sky overhead, and it smelled like the Bay Area. But beyond that, I had no clue where I was being held. No other prisoners were visible during my exercise period, and I got pretty bored with walking in circles. I strained my ears for any sound that might help me understand what this place was, but all I heard was the occasional vehicle, some distant conversations, a plane landing somewhere nearby. They brought me back to my cell and fed me. A half a pepperoni pie from Goat Hill Pizza, which I knew well, up on Potrero Hill. The carton with its familiar graphic and 415 phone number was a reminder that only a day before I'd been a free man in a free country, and that now I was a prisoner. I worried constantly about Daryl and fretted about my other friends. Maybe they'd been more cooperative and had been released. Maybe they'd told my parents and they were frantically calling around. Maybe not. The cell was fantastically spare, empty as my soul. I fantasized that the wall opposite my bunk was a screen that I could be hacking right now, opening the cell door. I fantasized about my workbench and the projects there. The old cans I was turning into a ghetto surround sound rig. The aerial photography kite cam I was building. My home brew laptop. I wanted to get out of there. I wanted to go home and have my friends and my school and my parents and my life back. I wanted to be able to go where I wanted to go, not be stuck pacing and pacing and pacing. They took my passwords for my USB keys next. Those held some interesting messages I downloaded from one online discussion group or another, some chat transcripts, things where people had helped me out with some of the knowledge I needed to do the things I did. There was nothing on there you couldn't find with Google, of course, but I didn't think that would count in my favor. I got exercise again that afternoon, and this time there were others in the yard when I got there, 4 other guys and 2 women, of all ages and racial backgrounds. I guess lots of people were doing things to earn their privileges. They gave me half an hour, and I tried to make conversation with the most normal-seeming of the other prisoners, a black guy about my age with a short afro. But when I introduced myself and stuck my hand out, he cut his eyes toward the cameras mounted ominously in the corners of the yard and kept walking without ever changing his facial expression. But then, just before they called my name and brought me back into the building, the door opened, and out came Vanessa. I'd never been more glad to see a friendly face. She looked tired and grumpy, but not hurt, and when she saw me, she shouted my name and ran to me. We hugged each other hard, and I realized I was shaking. Then I realized she was shaking, too. "Are you okay?" she said, holding me at arm's length. "I'm okay," I said. They told me they'd let me go if I gave them my passwords. "They keep asking me questions about you and Daryl." There was a voice blaring over the loudspeaker, shouting at us to stop talking, to walk. But we ignored it. "Answer them," I said instantly. "Anything they ask, answer them, if it'll get you out. How are Daryl and Holu?" "I haven't seen them." The door banged open and 4 big guards boiled out. 2 took me and 2 took Vanessa. They forced me to the ground and turned my head away from Vanessa, though I heard her getting the same treatment. Plastic cuffs went around my wrists, and then I was yanked to my feet and brought back to my cell. No dinner came that night. No breakfast came the next morning. No one came and brought me to the interrogation room to extract more of my secrets. The plastic cuffs didn't come off, and my shoulders burned, then ached, then went numb, then burned again. I lost all feeling in my hands. I had to pee. I couldn't undo my pants. I really, really had to pee. I pissed myself. They came for me after that, once the hot piss had cooled and gone clammy, making my already filthy jeans stick to my legs. They came for me and walked me down the long hall lined with doors, each door with its own barcode, each barcode a prisoner like me. They walked me down the corridor and brought me to the interrogation room, and it was like a different planet when I entered there. A world where things were normal, where everything didn't reek of urine. I felt so dirty and ashamed, and all those feelings of deserving what I got came back to me. Severe haircut lady was already sitting. She was perfect, coiffed and with just a little makeup. I smelled her hair stuff. She wrinkled her nose at me. I felt the shame rise in me. "Well, you've been a very naughty boy, haven't you? Aren't you a filthy thing?" Shame. I looked down at the table. I couldn't bear to look up. I wanted to tell her my email password and get gone. "What did you and your friend talk about in the yard?" I barked a laugh at the table. "I told her to answer your questions. I told her to cooperate." "So, do you give the orders?" I felt the blood sing in my ears. "Oh, come on," I said. "We play a game together. It's called Harajuku Fun Madness. I'm the team captain. We're not terrorists. We're high school students. I don't give her orders. I told her that we needed to be honest with you so that we could clear up any suspicion and get out of here." She didn't say anything for a moment. "How is Daryl?" I said.
"Who?"
"Daryl. You picked us up together, my friend. Someone had stabbed him in the Powell Street BART. That's why we were up on the surface, to get him help."
"I'm sure he's fine then," she said.
My stomach knotted and I almost threw up.
"You don't know? You haven't got him here?"
"Who we have here and who we don't have here is not something we're going to discuss with you. Ever. That's not something you're going to know. Marcus, you've seen what happens when you don't cooperate with us. You've seen what happens when you disobey our orders. You've been a little cooperative, and it's gotten you almost to the point where you might go free again. If you want to make that possibility into a reality, you'll stick to answering my questions."
I didn't say anything.
"You're learning. That's good. Now, your email passwords, please."
I was ready for this. I gave them everything. Server address, login, password. This didn't matter. I didn't keep any email on my server. I downloaded it all and kept it on my laptop at home, which downloaded and deleted my mail from the server every 60 seconds. They wouldn't get anything out of my mail. It got cleared off the server and stored on my laptop at home. Back to the cell. But they cut loose my hands and they gave me a shower and a pair of orange prison pants to wear. They were too big for me and hung down low on my hips, like a Mexican gang kid in the mission. That's where the baggy pants down your ass look comes from, you know that? From prison. I tell you what, it's less fun when it's not a fashion statement. They took away my jeans, and I spent another day in the cell. The walls were scratched cement over a steel grid. You could tell because the steel was rusting in the salt air, and the grid shone through the green paint in red-orange. My parents were out that window, somewhere. They came for me again the next day.
"We've been reading your mail for a day now. We changed the password so that your home computer couldn't fetch it."
Well, of course they had. I would have done the same, now that I thought of it.
"We have enough on you now to put you away for a very long time, Marcus. Your possession of these articles," she gestured at all my little gizmos, "and the data we recovered from your phone and memory sticks, as well as the subversive material we'd no doubt find if we raided your house and took your computer. It's enough to put you away until you're an old man. Do you understand that?"
I didn't believe it for a second.
There's no way a judge would say that all this stuff constituted any kind of real crime. It was free speech. It was technological tinkering. It wasn't a crime.
But who said that these people would ever put me in front of a judge?
"We know where you live. We know who your friends are. We know how you operate and how you think."
It dawned on me then. They were about to let me go. The room seemed to brighten. I heard myself breathing, short little breaths.
"We just want to know one thing. What was the delivery mechanism for the bombs on the bridge?"
I stopped breathing. The room darkened again.
What?
There were 10 charges on the bridge all along its length. They weren't in car trunks. They'd been placed there. Who placed them there and how did they get there?
What?
I said it again.
This is your last chance, Marcus, she said.
She looked sad.
You were doing so well until now.
Tell us this and you can go home. You can get a lawyer and defend yourself in a court of law. There are doubtless extenuating circumstances that you can use to explain your actions.
Just tell us this thing and you're gone.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I was crying and I didn't even care. Sobbing, blubbering.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
She shook her head.
Marcus, please. Let us help you. By now you know that we always get what we're after.
There was a gibbering sound in the back of my mind. They were insane. I pulled myself together, working hard to stop the tears.
Listen, lady, this is nuts. You've been into my stuff, you've seen it all. I'm a 17-year-old high school student, not a terrorist. You can't seriously think...
Marcus, haven't you figured out that we're serious yet?
She shook her head.
You get pretty good grades. I thought you'd be smarter than that.
She made a flicking gesture, and the guards picked me up by the armpits. Back in my cell, 100 little speeches occurred to me. The French call this esprit d'escalier, the spirit of the staircase. The snappy rebuttals that come to you after you leave the room and slink down the stairs. In my mind, I stood and delivered, telling her that I was a citizen who loved my freedom, which made me the patriot and made her the traitor. In my mind, I shamed her for turning my country into an armed camp. In my mind, I was eloquent and brilliant and reduced her to tears. But you know what? None of those fine words came back to me when they pulled me out the next day. All I could think of was freedom. My parents.
Hello, Marcus, she said. How are you feeling?
I looked down at the table. She had a neat pile of documents in front of her and her ubiquitous go cup of Starbucks beside her. I found it comforting somehow, a reminder that there was a real world out there somewhere, beyond the walls.
We're through investigating you, for now.
She let that hang there. Maybe it meant that she was letting me go. Maybe it meant that she was going to throw me in a pit and forget that I existed. And? I said finally.
And I want to impress on you again that we are very serious about this. Our country has experienced the worst attack ever committed on its soil. How many 9/11s do you want us to suffer before you're willing to cooperate? The details of our investigation are secret. We won't stop at anything in our efforts to bring the perpetrators of these heinous crimes to justice. Do you understand that?
Yes, I mumbled.
We're going to send you home today, but you are a marked man. You have not been found to be above suspicion. We're only releasing you because we're done questioning you for now. But from now on, you belong to us. We will be watching you. We will be waiting for you to make a misstep. Do you understand that we can watch you closely, all the time?
Yes, I mumbled.
Good. You will never speak of what happened here to anyone, ever. This is a matter of national security. Do you know that the death penalty still holds for treason in time of war?
Yes, I mumbled.
Good boy, she purred. We have some papers here for you to sign.
She pushed the stack of papers across the table to me.
Little post-its with "sign here" printed on them had been stuck throughout them. A guard undid my cuffs. I paged through the papers and my eyes watered and my head swam. I couldn't make sense of them. I tried to decipher the legalese. It seemed that I was signing a declaration that I had been voluntarily held and submitted to voluntary questioning of my own free will.
What happens if I don't sign this? I said.
She snatched the papers back and made that flicking gesture again. The guards jerked me to my feet.
Wait!
I cried.
Please, I'll sign them.
They dragged me to the door. All I could see was that door. All I could think of was it closing behind me. I lost it. I wept. I begged to be allowed to sign the papers, to be so close to freedom and have it snatched away. It made me ready to do anything. I can't count the number of times I've heard someone say, "Oh, I'd rather die than do something or other." I've said it myself now and again. But that was the first time I understood what it really meant. I would have rather died than go back to my cell. I begged as they took me out into the corridor. I told them I'd sign anything. She called out to the guards and they stopped. They brought me back. They sat me down. One of them put the pen in my hand. Of course, I signed and signed and signed. My jeans and t-shirt were back in my cell, laundered and folded. They smelled of detergent. I put them on and washed my face and sat on my cot and stared at the wall. They'd taken everything from me. First my privacy, then my dignity. I'd been ready to sign anything. I would have signed a confession that said I'd assassinated Abraham Lincoln. I tried to cry, but it was like my eyes were dry, out of tears. They got me again. A guard approached me with a hood, like the hood I'd been put in when they picked us up, whenever that was, days ago, weeks ago. The hood went over my head and cinched tight at my neck. I was in total darkness, and the air was stifling and stale. I was raised to my feet and walked down corridors, upstairs, on gravel, up a gangplank, on a ship's steel deck. My hands were chained behind me to a railing. I knelt on the deck and listened to the thrum of the diesel engines. The ship moved. A hint of salt air made its way into the hood. It was drizzling and my clothes were heavy with water. I was outside, even if my head was in a bag. I was outside, in the world, moments from my freedom. They came for me and led me off the boat and over uneven ground, up three metal stairs. My wrists were unshackled. My hood was removed. I was back in the truck. Severe haircut woman was there, at the little desk she'd sat at before. She had a Ziploc bag with her, and inside it were my phone and other little devices, my wallet and the change from my pockets. She handed them to me wordlessly. I filled my pockets. It felt so weird to have everything back in its familiar place, to be wearing my familiar clothes. Outside the truck's back door, I heard the familiar sounds of my familiar city. A guard passed me my backpack. The woman extended her hand to me. I just looked at it. She put it down and gave me a wry smile. Then she mimed, zipping up her lips and pointed to me and opened the door. It was daylight outside, gray and drizzling. I was looking down an alley toward cars and trucks and bikes zipping down the road. I stood transfixed on the truck's top step, staring at freedom. My knees shook. I knew now that they were playing with me again. In a moment, the guards would grab me and drag me back inside. The bag would go over my head again, and I would be back on the boat and sent off to the prison again, to the endless, unanswerable questions. I barely held myself back from stuffing my fist in my mouth. Then I forced myself to go down one stair, another stair, the last stair. My sneakers crunched down on the crap on the alley's floor. Broken glass, a needle, gravel. I took a step. Another. I reached the mouth of the alley and stepped onto the sidewalk. No one grabbed me. I was free. Then strong arms threw themselves around me. I nearly cried. Chapter 5. But it was Van, and she was crying, and hugging me so hard I couldn't breathe. I didn't care. I hugged her back, my face buried in her hair.
You're okay,
she said.
I'm okay, I managed.
She finally let go of me, and another set of arms wrapped themselves around me. It was Holu. They were both there. He whispered,
You're safe, bro,
in my ear and hugged me even tighter than Vanessa had. When he let go, I looked around.
Where's Daryl?
I asked. They both looked at each other.
Maybe he's still in the truck, Holu said.
We turned and looked at the truck at the alley's end. It was a nondescript white 18-wheeler. Someone had already brought the little folding staircase inside. The rear lights glowed red, and the truck rolled backwards toward us, emitting a steady eep, eep, eep.
Wait!
I shouted as it accelerated toward us.
Wait! What about Daryl?
The truck drew closer. I kept shouting,
What about Daryl?
Holu and Vanessa each had me by an arm and were dragging me away. I struggled against them, shouting. The truck pulled out of the alley's mouth and reversed into the street and pointed itself downhill and drove away. I tried to run after it, but Van and Holu wouldn't let me go. I sat down on the sidewalk and put my arms around my knees and cried. I cried and cried and cried, loud sobs of the sort I hadn't done since I was a little kid. They wouldn't stop coming. I couldn't stop shaking. Vanessa and Holu got me to my feet and moved me a little ways up the street. There was a Muni bus stop with a bench, and they sat me on it. They were both crying, too, and we held each other for a while. And I knew we were crying for Daryl, whom none of us ever expected to see again. We were north of Chinatown, at the part where it starts to become North Beach, a neighborhood with a bunch of neon strip clubs and the legendary City Lights Counterculture bookstore, where the beat poetry movement had been founded back in the 1950s. I knew this part of town well. My parents' favorite Italian restaurant was here, and they liked to take me here for big plates of linguine and huge Italian ice cream mountains with candied figs and lethal little espressos afterward. Now it was a different place. A place where I was tasting freedom for the first time in what seemed like an eternity. We checked our pockets and found enough money to get a table at one of the Italian restaurants, out on the sidewalk, under an awning. The pretty waitress lighted a gas heater with a barbecue lighter, took our orders and went inside. The sensation of giving orders, of controlling my destiny, was the most amazing thing I'd ever felt. How long were we in there? I asked.
6 days, Vanessa said.
I got 5, Holu said.
I didn't count.
What did they do to you?
Vanessa said. I didn't want to talk about it, but they were both looking at me. Once I started, I couldn't stop. I told them everything, even when I'd been forced to piss myself, and they took it all in silently. I paused when the waitress delivered our sodas and waited until she got out of earshot, then finished. In the telling, it receded into the distance. By the end of it, I couldn't tell if I was embroidering the truth or if I was making it all seem less bad. My memories swam like little fish that I snatched at, and sometimes they wriggled out of my grasp. Holu shook his head.
They were hard on you, dude,
he said. He told us about his stay there. They'd questioned him, mostly about me, and he'd kept on telling them the truth, sticking to a plain telling of the facts about that day and about our friendship. They had gotten him to repeat it over and over again, but they hadn't played games with his head the way they had with me. He'd eaten his meals in a mess hall with a bunch of other people, and been given time in a TV room where they were shown last year's blockbusters on video. Vanessa's story was only slightly different. After she'd gotten them angry by talking to me, they'd taken away her clothes and made her wear a set of orange prison coveralls. She'd been left in her cell for 2 days without contact, though she'd been fed regularly. But mostly it was the same as Holu. The same questions, repeated again and again.
"They really hated you," Holu said. "Really had it in for you. Why?"
I couldn't imagine why. Then I remembered. You can cooperate, or you can be very, very sorry. It was because I wouldn't unlock my phone for them that first night. That's why they singled me out. I couldn't believe it, but there was no other explanation. It had been sheer vindictiveness. My mind reeled at the thought. They had done all that as a mere punishment for defying their authority. I had been scared. Now I was angry.
"Those bastards," I said softly. "They did it to get back at me for mouthing off."
Holu swore, and then Vanessa cut loose in Korean, something she only did when she was really, really angry.
"I'm going to get them," I whispered, staring at my soda. "I'm going to get them."
Holu shook his head. "You can't, you know. You can't fight back against that." None of us much wanted to talk about revenge then. Instead, we talked about what we would do next. We had to go home. Our phones' batteries were dead, and it had been years since this neighborhood had any payphones. We just needed to go home. I even thought about taking a taxi, but there wasn't enough money between us to make that possible. So we walked. On the corner, we pumped some quarters into a San Francisco Chronicle newspaper box and stopped to read the front section. It had been 5 days since the bombs went off, but it was still all over the front cover. Severe haircut woman had talked about the bridge blowing up, and I'd just assumed that she was talking about the Golden Gate Bridge, but I was wrong. The terrorists had blown up the Bay Bridge. "Why the hell would they blow up the Bay Bridge?" I said. "The Golden Gate is the one on all the postcards." Even if you've never been to San Francisco, chances are you know what the Golden Gate looks like. It's that big orange suspension bridge that swoops dramatically from the old military base called the Presidio to Sausalito, where all the cutesy wine country towns are, with their scented candle shops and art galleries. It's picturesque as hell, and it's practically the symbol for the state of California. If you go to the Disneyland California Adventure Park, there's a replica of it just past the gates, with a monorail running over it. So, naturally, I assumed that if you were going to blow up a bridge in San Francisco, that's the one you'd blow.
"They probably got scared off by all the cameras and stuff," Holu said. "The National Guard's always checking cars at both ends, and there's all those suicide fences and junk all along it."
"People have been jumping off the Golden Gate since it opened in 1937. They stopped counting after the 1,000th suicide in 1995.
"Yeah," Vanessa said. "Plus the Bay Bridge actually goes somewhere."
"The Bay Bridge goes from downtown San Francisco to Oakland, and thence to Berkeley, the East Bay townships that are home to many of the people who live and work in town. It's one of the only parts of the Bay Area where a normal person can afford a house big enough to really stretch out in. And there's also the university and a bunch of light industry over there. The BART goes under the bay and connects the two cities, too. But it's the Bay Bridge that sees most of the traffic. The Golden Gate was a nice bridge if you were a tourist or a rich retiree living out in wine country, but it was mostly ornamental. The Bay Bridge was San Francisco's workhorse bridge." I thought about it for a minute.
"You guys are right," I said. "But I don't think that's all of it. We keep acting like terrorists attack landmarks because they hate landmarks. Terrorists don't hate landmarks or bridges or airplanes. They just want to screw stuff up and make people scared. To make terror. So of course they went after the Bay Bridge after the Golden Gate got all those cameras. After airplanes got all metal detectored and x-rayed." I thought about it some more, staring blankly at the cars rolling down the street, at the people walking down the sidewalks, at the city all around me. Terrorists don't hate airplanes or bridges. They love terror. It was so obvious I couldn't believe I'd never thought of it before. I guess that being treated like a terrorist for a few days was enough to clarify my thinking. The other two were staring at me. I'm right, aren't I? All this crap, all the x-rays and ID checks, they're all useless, aren't they? They nodded slowly. Worse than useless, I said, my voice going up and cracking. Because they ended up with us in prison, with Daryl. I hadn't thought of Daryl since we sat down, and now it came back to me. My friend, missing, disappeared. I stopped talking and ground my jaws together. We have to tell our parents, Holu said. We should get a lawyer, Vanessa said. I thought of telling my story, of telling the world what had become of me, of the videos that would no doubt come out, of me weeping, reduced to a groveling animal. We can't tell them anything, I said without thinking. What do you mean? Ben said. We can't tell them anything, I repeated. You heard her. If we talk, they'll come back for us. They'll do to us what they did to Daryl. You're joking, Holu said. You want us to... I want us to fight back, I said. I want to stay free so that I can do that. If we go out there and blab, they'll just say that we're kids making it up. We don't even know where we were held. No one will believe us. Then, one day, they'll come for us. I'm telling my parents that I was in one of those camps on the other side of the bay. I came over to meet you guys there and we got stranded and just got loose today. They said in the papers that people were still wandering home from them. I can't do that, Vanessa said. After what they did to you, how can you even think of doing that? It happened to me. That's the point. This is me and them now. I'll beat them. I'll get Daryl. I'm not going to take this lying down. But once our parents are involved, that's it for us. No one will believe us and no one will care. If we do it my way, people will care. What's your way? Holu said. What's your plan? I don't know yet, I admitted. Give me until tomorrow morning. Give me that, at least. I knew that once they'd kept it a secret for a day, it would have to be a secret forever. Our parents would be even more skeptical if we suddenly remembered that we'd been held in a secret prison instead of taken care of in a refugee camp. Van and Holu looked at each other. I'm just asking for a chance, I said. We'll work out the story on the way, get it straight. Give me one day, just one day. The other two nodded glumly, and we set off downhill again, heading back toward home. I lived on Potrero Hill, Vanessa lived in the North Mission, and Holu lived in Noe Valley. Three wildly different neighborhoods, just a few minutes' walk from one another. We turned onto Market Street and stopped dead. The street was barricaded at every corner, the cross streets reduced to a single lane, and parked down the whole length of Market Street were big, nondescript 18-wheelers, like the one that had carried us, hooded, away from the ship's docks and to Chinatown. Each one had three steel steps leading down from the back, and they buzzed with activity as soldiers, people in suits, and cops went in and out of them. The suits wore little badges on their lapels, and the soldiers scanned them as they went in and out, wireless authorization badges. As we walked past one, I got a look at it and saw the familiar logo, Department of Homeland Security. The soldier saw me staring and stared back hard, glaring at me. I got the message and moved on. I peeled away from the gang at Van Ness. We clung to each other and cried and promised to call each other. The walk back to Potrero Hill has an easy route and a hard route, the latter taking you over some of the steepest hills in the city, the kind of thing that you see car chases on in action movies,
with cars catching air as they soar over the zenith. I always take the hard way home. It's all residential streets, and the old Victorian houses they call painted ladies for their gaudy elaborate paint jobs and front gardens with scented flowers and tall grasses. House cats stare at you from hedges, and there are hardly any homeless. It was so quiet on those streets that it made me wish I'd taken the other route, through the Mission, which is raucous, is probably the best word for it. Loud and vibrant, lots of rowdy drunks and angry crackheads and unconscious junkies, and also lots of families with strollers, old ladies gossiping on stoops, lowriders with boom cars going thumpa-thumpa-thumpa down the streets. There were hipsters and mopey emo art students, and even a couple old-school punk rockers, old guys with pot bellies bulging out beneath their dead Kennedys shirts. Also drag queens, angry gang kids, graffiti artists, and bewildered gentrifiers trying not to get killed while their real estate investments matured. I went up Goat Hill and walked past Goat Hill Pizza, which made me think of the jail I'd been held in, and I had to sit down on the bench out in front of the restaurant until my shakes passed. Then I noticed the truck up the hill from me, a nondescript 18-wheeler with 3 metal steps coming down from the back end. I got up and got moving. I felt the eyes watching me from all directions. I hurried the rest of the way home. I didn't look at the painted ladies or the gardens or the house cats. I kept my eyes down. Both my parents' cars were in the driveway, even though it was the middle of the day. Of course, Dad works in the East Bay, so he'd be stuck at home while they worked on the bridge. Mom? Well, who knew why Mom was home? They were home for me. Even before I'd finished unlocking the door, it had been jerked out of my hand and flung wide. There were both of my parents, looking gray and haggard, bug-eyed and staring at me. We stood there in frozen tableau for a moment. Then they both rushed forward and dragged me into the house, nearly tripping me up. They were both talking so loud and fast, all I could hear was a wordless, roaring gabble, and they both hugged me and cried, and I cried too, and we just stood there like that in the little foyer, crying and making almost words until we ran out of steam and went into the kitchen. I did what I always did when I came home. Got myself a glass of water from the filter in the fridge, and dug a couple cookies out of the biscuit barrel that Mom's sister had sent us from England. The normalcy of this made my heart stop hammering, my heart catching up with my brain, and soon we were all sitting at the table. "Where have you been?" they both said, more or less in unison. I had given this some thought on the way home. "I got trapped," I said. "In Oakland. I was there with some friends doing a project, and we were all quarantined."
"For 5 days?"
"Yeah," I said. "Yeah, it was really bad." I'd read about the quarantines in the Chronicle, and I cribbed shamelessly from the quotes they'd published.
"Yeah. Everyone who got caught in the cloud, they thought we'd been attacked with some kind of superbug, and they packed us into shipping containers in the docklands like sardines. It was really hot and sticky. Not much food, either."
"Christ," Dad said, his fists balling up on the table. Dad teaches in Berkeley 3 days a week, working with a few grad students in the library science program. The rest of the time he consults for clients in the city and down the peninsula, thirdwave.coms that are doing various things with archives. He's a mild-mannered librarian by profession, but he'd been a real radical in the 60s and wrestled a little in high school. I'd seen him get crazy angry now and again. I'd even made him that angry now and again. And he could seriously lose it when he was hulking out. He once threw a swing set from IKEA across my granddad's whole lawn when it fell apart for the 50th time while he was assembling it. "Barbarians," Mom said. She's been living in America since she was a teenager, but she still comes over all British when she encounters American cops, health care,
airport security or homelessness. Then the word is barbarians, and her accent comes back strong. We'd been to London twice to see her family, and I can't say as it felt any more civilized than San Francisco, just more cramped. But they let us go and ferried us over today. I was improvising now.
Are you hurt? Mom said. Hungry?
Sleepy?
Yeah, a little of all that. Also, dopey, dark, sneezy, and bashful.
We had a family tradition of Seven Dwarfs jokes. They both smiled a little, but their eyes were still wet. I felt really bad for them. They must have been out of their minds with worry. I was glad for a chance to change the subject. I'd totally love to eat.
I'll order a pizza from Goat Hill, Dad said.
No, not that, I said. They both looked at me like I'd sprouted antennae. I normally have a thing about Goat Hill pizza, as in, I can normally eat it like a goldfish eats his food, gobbling until it either runs out or I pop. I tried to smile. I just don't feel like pizza, I said lamely. Let's order some curry, okay? Thank heaven that San Francisco is takeout central. Mom went to the drawer of takeout menus, more normalcy, feeling like a drink of water on a dry, sore throat, and rifled through them. We spent a couple of distracting minutes going through the menu from the halal Pakistani place on Valencia. I settled on a mixed tandoori grill and creamed spinach with farmer's cheese, a salted mango lassi, much better than it sounds, and little fried pastries in sugar syrup. Once the food was ordered, the question started again. They'd heard from Van's, Holu's, and Daryl's families, of course, and had tried to report us missing. The police were taking names, but there were so many displaced persons that they weren't going to open files on anyone unless they were still missing after 7 days. Meanwhile, millions of have-you-seen sites had popped up on the net. A couple of the sites were old MySpace clones that had run out of money and saw a new lease on life from all the attention. After all, some venture capitalists had missing family in the Bay Area. Maybe if they were recovered, the site would attract some new investment. I grabbed Dad's laptop and looked through them. They were plastered with advertising, of course, and pictures of missing people, mostly grad photos, wedding pictures and that sort of thing. It was pretty ghoulish. I found my pic and saw that it was linked to Van's, Holu's, and Daryl's. There was a little form for marking people found and another one for writing up notes about other missing people. I filled in the fields for me and Holu and Van and left Daryl blank.
You forgot Daryl, Dad said.
He didn't like Daryl much. Once he'd figured out that a couple inches were missing out of one of the bottles in his liquor cabinet. And to my enduring shame, I'd blamed it on Daryl. In truth, of course, it had been both of us, just fooling around, trying out vodka and cokes during an all-night gaming session. He wasn't with us, I said. The lie tasted bitter in my mouth.
Oh, my God,
my mom said. She squeezed her hands together.
We just assumed when you came home that you'd all been together.
No, I said, the lie growing. No, he was supposed to meet us, but we never met up. He's probably just stuck over in Berkeley. He was going to take the BART over. Mom made a whimpering sound. Dad shook his head and closed his eyes.
Don't you know about the BART?
He said. I shook my head. I could see where this was going. I felt like the ground was rushing up to me.
They blew it up, Dad said.
The bastards blew it up at the same time as the bridge.
That hadn't been on the front page of the Chronicle. But then, a BART blowout under the water wouldn't be nearly as picturesque as the images of the bridge hanging in tatters and pieces over the bay. The BART tunnel from the Embarcadero in San Francisco to the West Oakland station was submerged. I went back to Dad's computer and surfed the headlines. No one was sure, but the body count was in the thousands.
between the cars that plummeted 191 feet to the sea and the people drowned in the trains, the deaths were mounting. One reporter claimed to have interviewed an identity counterfeiter who'd helped dozens of people walk away from their old lives by simply vanishing after the attacks, getting new ID made up and slipping away from bad marriages, bad debts, and bad lives. Dad actually got tears in his eyes, and Mom was openly crying. They each hugged me again, patting me with their hands as if to assure themselves that I was really there. They kept telling me they loved me. I told them I loved them too. We had a weepy dinner, and Mom and Dad had each had a couple glasses of wine, which was a lot for them. I told them that I was getting sleepy, which was true, and mooched up to my room. I wasn't going to bed, though. I needed to get online and find out what was going on. I needed to talk to Holu and Vanessa. I needed to get working on finding Daryl. I crept up to my room and opened the door. I hadn't seen my old bed in what felt like 1,000 years. I lay down on it and reached over to my bedstand to grab my laptop. I must have not plugged it in all the way. The electrical adapter needed to be jiggled just right, so it had slowly discharged while I was away. I plugged it back in and gave it a minute or two to charge up before trying to power it up again. I used the time to get undressed and throw my clothes in the trash. I never wanted to see them again, and put on a clean pair of boxers and a fresh T-shirt. The fresh laundered clothes, straight out of my drawers, felt so familiar and comfortable, like getting hugged by my parents. I powered up my laptop and punched a bunch of pillows into place behind me at the top of the bed. I scooched back and opened my computer's lid and settled it onto my thighs. It was still booting, and man, those icons creeping across the screen looked good. It came all the way up, and then it started giving me more low power warnings. I checked the power cable again and wiggled it, and they went away. The power jack was really flaking out. In fact, it was so bad that I couldn't actually get anything done. Every time I took my hand off the power cable, it lost contact, and the computer started to complain about its battery. I took a closer look at it. The whole case of my computer was slightly misaligned. The seam split in an angular gape that started narrow and widened toward the back. Sometimes you look at a piece of equipment and discover something like this, and you wonder, was it always like that? Maybe you just never noticed. But with my laptop, that wasn't possible. You see, I built it. After the Board of Ed issued us all school books, there was no way my parents were going to buy me a computer of my own, even though technically the school book didn't belong to me, and I wasn't supposed to install software on it or mod it. I had some money saved, odd jobs, Christmases and birthdays, a little bit of judicious eBaying, put it all together, and I had enough money to buy a totally crappy 5-year-old machine. So, Daryl and I built one instead. You can buy laptop cases just like you can buy cases for desktop PCs, though they're a little more specialized than plain old PCs. I'd built a couple PCs with Daryl over the years, scavenging parts from Craigslist and garage sales, and ordering stuff from cheap Taiwanese vendors we found on the net. I figured that building a laptop would be the best way to get the power I wanted at the price I could afford. To build your own laptop, you start by ordering a bare book, a machine with just a little hardware in it and all the right slots. The good news was, once I was done, I had a machine that was a whole pound lighter than the Dell I'd had my eye on, ran faster, and cost 1/3 of what I would have paid Dell. The bad news was that assembling a laptop is like building one of those ships in a bottle. It's all finicky work with tweezers and magnifying glasses, trying to get everything to fit in that little case. Unlike a full-sized PC, which is mostly air, every cubic millimeter of space in a laptop is spoken for. Every time I thought I had it, I'd go to screw the thing back together and find that something was keeping the case from closing all the way,
and it'd be back to the drawing board. So I knew exactly how the seam on my laptop was supposed to look when the thing was closed, and it was not supposed to look like this. I kept jiggling the power adapter, but it was hopeless. There was no way I was going to get the thing to boot without taking it apart. I groaned and put it beside the bed. I'd deal with it in the morning. That was the theory, anyway. 2 hours later, I was still staring at the ceiling, playing back movies in my head of what they'd done to me, what I should have done. All regrets and esprit d'escalier. I rolled out of bed. It had gone midnight, and I'd heard my parents hit the sack at 11. I grabbed the laptop and cleared some space on my desk and clipped the little LED lamps to the temples of my magnifying glasses and pulled out a set of little precision screwdrivers. A minute later, I had the case open and the keyboard removed, and I was staring at the guts of my laptop. I got a can of compressed air and blew out the dust that the fan had sucked in, and looked things over. Something wasn't right. I couldn't put my finger on it, but then it had been months since I'd had the lid off this thing. Luckily, the third time I'd had to open it up and struggle to close it again, I'd gotten smart. I'd taken a photo of the guts with everything in place. I hadn't been totally smart. At first, I'd just left that pic on my hard drive. And naturally, I couldn't get to it when I had the laptop in parts. But then I'd printed it out and stuck it in my messy drawer of papers, the dead tree graveyard where I kept all the warranty cards and pin-out diagrams. I shuffled them. They seemed messier than I remembered, and brought out my photo. I set it down next to the computer and kind of unfocused my eyes, trying to find things that looked out of place. Then I spotted it. The ribbon cable that connected the keyboard to the logic board wasn't connected right. That was a weird one. There was no torque on that part, nothing to dislodge it in the course of normal operations. I tried to press it back down again and discovered that the plug wasn't just badly mounted. There was something between it and the board. I tweezed it out and shone my light on it. There was something new in my keyboard. It was a little chunk of hardware, only a 16th of an inch thick, with no markings. The keyboard was plugged into it, and it was plugged into the board. In other words, it was perfectly situated to capture all the keystrokes I made while I typed on my machine. It was a bug. My heart thudded in my ears. It was dark and quiet in the house, but it wasn't a comforting dark. There were eyes out there. Eyes and ears, and they were watching me, surveilling me. The surveillance I faced at school had followed me home, but this time it wasn't just the Board of Education looking over my shoulder. The Department of Homeland Security had joined them. I almost took the bug out. Then I figured that whoever put it there would know that it was gone. I left it in. It made me sick to do it. I looked around for more tampering. I couldn't find any, but did that mean there hadn't been any? Someone had broken into my room and planted this device, had disassembled my laptop and reassembled it. There were lots of other ways to wiretap a computer. I could never find them all. I put the machine together with numb fingers. This time the case wouldn't snap shut just right. But the power cable stayed in. I booted it up and set my fingers on the keyboard, thinking that I would run some diagnostics and see what was what. But I couldn't do it. Hell, maybe my room was wiretapped. Maybe there was a camera spying on me now. I'd been feeling paranoid when I got home. Now I was nearly out of my skin. It felt like I was back in jail, back in the interrogation room. Stalked by entities who had me utterly in their power. It made me want to cry. Only one thing for it.